everybody. This is BitNote. We'll be playing video game music and talking about the games they're from. Hope you enjoy. All right, so this is David Collins, and for our first track, you know, when a lot of people talk about video game music, they think of all the beeps and blops, kind of like that intro theme that I started us off all off with. But if you're a long-time listener to this show, you'll know there's so many other different kinds of music genres and styles out there. But to start with on today's show, I think we'll go back with the basics and the fun. This is from a game called Bubble Bobble, and definitely one of my favourites for reasons I'll talk about later. And we'll be playing from the title screen, stage intro, and then right onto the main theme, as you might remember when you play the game itself. Hope you enjoy it, and And of course, as I said, that is from Bubble Bobble, a classic game of the early 90s developed by Taito. And the music you just heard there was from actually something called Zuntata, which is Taito's in-house band, basically. It's got a whole list of members. Hishio Ogura, who's meant to be the guy who started it all, Tamio Kawamoto, Mashiko Taketki, Norihiro Furukawa, Yasuhisa Watanabe, Shushiro Nakazawa, Kazuo Yumimo, Tomohito Takahashi, Munihiro Nakaishi, and Katsushishi Ishiyakawa. So essentially a bunch of different people. I'm not, obviously, they're probably not all in the band at the same time, but we're basically the ones who were who made the music for this game, and it is classic. Bubble Bobble is like one of those games that just feels so right. I mean, when I was a kid, I played through a lot of games, and I liked platformer games, you know, those games where you sort of jump around and defeat a bunch of enemies. Bubble Bobble was one of those games that just felt so right. It was like, it's like when you play games, you know, if you're technical, you'll break it down as a system of rules. If you're visual, you'll break it down as a set of assets. But if you break down a video game in any way, and there's something that you, there's always something you miss, and maybe it wasn't there in the first place, maybe the game wasn't that good, but there's something that you miss, and Bubble Bobble had that something. And I'm not sure what it was. Everything flowed together so perfectly about it. You had that great music that seemed so bubbly, and yes, very nice pun there. And you just find yourself in these levels, and you basically had to shoot these bubbles at the enemies, who are all like cartoons that we caught in bubbles, and you have to come up and burst the bubbles. And then when all the enemies and levels were defeated, you went down to the next one. So they're all very bright, basic, but fun and colourful graphics. And there are all these little collectibles you collected, including one power-up that seemed to be a McDonald's French fries. But there are also lots of other things like cakes or umbrellas, which would, for some reason, umbrella was something that meant you get to a power-up that meant you get to skip a few levels. It was present in one or two, more than one video game. I'm not sure how that one turned out. But something was just beautiful about it. It was straightforward, but everything was just, you know, it's the levels were designed. You jumped around, you made the right connections, you tried to get all the enemies grouped up and tried to burst them in one shot. And just something felt so right about everything. And just how you went from level to level, all the little tiny little details you picked up, the way you, if you grabbed all the letters that spelled out EXTEND, you'd not only get an extra life, but you get to skip the level you were currently on. And it's just, and of course, there was a two-player mode. And I mean, two-player is something that's completely, you know, that it's completely, people don't realize how important to a lot of times co-op is, although it's changed a little. I mean, there are some games that work towards co-op, but I mean, in there you could have a friend sitting beside you and you both play together to get through all the levels. And there was a plot basically about your girlfriends being stolen and having to get them back. I actually played it on the Amiga version where they didn't actually show the girlfriends being stolen, so yeah, I didn't really notice it that much. But I don't know, it was just, it's a classic, because as you can see, that the music, the just the feel, and the just sense of fun, really. I mean, that's what it was all about. You were in this crazy world that didn't make any sense, and you weren't always quite sure what you were going to do, but you were just going to have a damn fun time doing it, just hitting through all the levels, finding all the fun collectibles, and just seeing if you could just go that bit further in the game than you previously did. And that was Bubble Bobble. Such a lovely game. And it's been released a few times. Back then it was on the arcade and the NES, and it was one of those games that was supported to all the different platforms. And I just suppose I always remember that was one of my earliest connections of a game that really meant something to me, and it was just so much fun. Okay, as I said, a lot of games have that sort of soundtrack. By the way, I'm not sure I want to go into history, but obviously since the mid-90s, games have had their soundtracks stored on CDs, so that's why you can get much higher quality music. But let's move on to a music track that actually might take you by surprise. It is from a video game. It's from, like Bubble Bobble, this is a video game that really sets itself out on its own sort of thing. So I hope you enjoy. Well, that changed the tone somewhat. That was Perito Caligero by Daniel Indart. And Daniel's actually has done a huge amount of music for films and TV shows like The Sopranos. A lot of Latin music, and you can see it from there. And it's from a game called Tropico by Pop Top Software. Now, Tropico is one of those fun games. There are some games out there, by listening to the concept, you can say, okay, this is something interesting. Essentially, you are the dictator of a Caribbean island, and you basically, like any game, you can change the terms, but the idea is you have to take your island and make it into a huge success. Usually it starts out very impoverished, you know, only a few people living on the island and everything, and you have to basically develop the country into a modern beacon of civilization. It's more or less a stand-in for Cuba. Not exactly, not explicitly, but you know, you're kind of guessing it. That's pretty much the heavy inspiration. But smartly enough, obviously, it's not actually considered Cuba because it, you know, Cuba's in game. There are other locations, and one of them is listed as Cuba. So the idea is, you know, you're in the Caribbean, and you basically have to move your country forward, and you have to lead through a lot of challenges. The default mode has you going from 1950 up until 2000, and you got to deal with the Americans and the and the Russians. You got to make sure that you're both on both their sides. You got to, you know, they give you foreign aid, which is hugely vital. So obviously you can't, if you're more communist approach, you get more money from the Soviets. If you're more capitalist, you get it from the Americans. Meanwhile, you got to do a lot of smart stuff. You got to build factories. You got to make sure you got enough money. You got to build up. You got to start building buildings for a lot of the citizens of your country. And this is where things start to get a bit tricky, because if your country becomes successful, you start getting a lot of immigrants. I mean, you know, so you've got to suddenly figure out, okay, do you want to, you know, you've got to suddenly realize that you got to make sure that the immigrants, you know, work well in society. Or the other problem is make sure that it's possible to build a foreign embassy and then be able to instrument a policy against the immigrants, but which I never did. But you also get tourists as well, which are also a lot of funny. So you got to build up all these resorts and nice fun stuff. But here's the problem. If you make a complete mess of how you build your city, it might become a disgusting urban sprawl sort of area. So you got to make sure that I'm saying Americans because they're always dressed gaudy, but the truth is the tourists are from everywhere in the world in the game. And so you got to build nice tourist resorts to get all the money out of them and try to make sure that they don't see how sickening the actual city is. You see, I kind of made a mess of this game the first time I played it. I kind of like built all these really big buildings, population centers around near to each other, and they completely polluted the nearby land. So I ended up building an entire tourist resort in the other end of the island and trying to usher off all the tourists to there so that they enjoy the place, they get a nice sense of it, and that they spend their money there. You can also do a lot of other fun stuff as well. I mean, you can, one thing I liked actually, one of the things you can build in this game is, you know, dictator's childhood home. You can basically build your own childhood home for the tourists to visit. And if that's not a nice cynical version of tourism in a sort of a banana republic, I don't know what is. It's also very tricky because you also have to build up the educational system. You have to build a school and then you have to build a college, and you actually realize that you end up with a problem, because if you over-educate your population, you know, with all these people with degrees and stuff, but not enough people to actually do, you know, the hard work of like lifting, you know, deforest, you know, cutting down trees to make lumber, which you can export, or taking care of the tobacco crop and stuff. And of course, there's also building communication centers and trying to build up enough entertainment. Each citizen of your island, well, usually has attributes about whether they're happy and what they believe in and what will gain their approval and lose their approval. And so you have to like play a lot of games to make sure they're all happy. And on top of that, they can also end up forcing you to do elections. So this is where things get more tricky. Do you let them have the elections and risk losing your seat? Do you let them have elections and then deliberately rig the elections, which risks them finding out and keep getting more angry at them? Or you just straight out defy getting elections, which will get you a lot of international bad press. But, you know, at the same time, you know, it'll make sure that you're still the guy in charge. So you can see there's kind of a whole there's a lot, you can learn a lot about politics and city building and a bit about how the structure of society from this game. I mean, it's still a simplistic overview. It's an abstraction all the same, but it's just a lot of fun. You can just rule the country in the way that you want, and well, you know, if the citizens will let you rule it in that way, and depending on the difficulty mode, and you basically have to do all these management things, trying to figure out, you know, what's the best way to move your country forward, keep the money coming in, keep the production high, keep the citizens happy, and keep you fairly comfortable, and quite possibly, you know, and the game of course also lets you filter off a bit of the money into your own personal bank account for your own happiness. I mean, the game's not cynical. I mean, everything, but it does allow you to enact certain political realities. And it's a fun game, and spawned many sequels. It's also got a great, vibrant, colourful, bright view, which always gets me. I'm a fan of bright colours, and when you're dealing with a Caribbean island of the deep blue sea and the bright green of the brush, I mean, you know, you kind of sold me at least for trying it out. There are plenty of sequels available, each one improving it. And if you like the, it's a pretty easy series to buy online and download. So or even buy in shops. I think maybe the most recent version or something. So yeah, I definitely recommend it. It's a fun game. All right, so we're going to change the theme a little here. Last week I played a game from a DS game developed by Sing, C-I-N-G, and here's some more music by another game that studio produced. It's slightly different. Here you go. What you listened to was called Trace Memory, and the music is from another code, Two Memories, which is also called Trace Memory, and was developed by Sing, as I said. The music it's a little tricky who made that music, but it was, the sound credited on the game is Makoto Hagiura, Kenjiro Matsuo, and Yuichi Nakamura. So I'm certainly not used to pronouncing Japanese names over here, but obviously not as much as I should be used to it. So essentially, Trace Memory, I kind of got an import on that game, so excuse me if I keep using the American name, is actually kind of an interesting game. It's a story game. You basically play this daughter who's arriving on Blood Edward Island, and you're trying, yes, that's the name, and you're basically trying to search for answers, both of your father, who's left you this little item that's basically a Nintendo DS, and just trying to find out a little about what's going on. And then you meet a ghost and you try to figure out what's going on with him as well. The plot is the plot's kind of interesting. Most of the time it kind of stays out of the way, but you try to figure out what the but towards the end you get the climax and you get some revelations going, so that's fine. It was done at a time when the DS was pretty new, so there's a lot of like gimmicky uses for it then. Anytime a game console introduces new technology, be it motion sensing, touchscreen, what have you, there will always be a large amount of people developers who will just completely use it in every way possible without thinking first. Well, maybe they do think first, but without really considering, is it the best way to be doing it? A lot of people complain about this for the Wii, but and right now with their recent PlayStation Vita launch, people are complaining about that for the backside of the touchscreen. But in this case, like I said, it was usually using the stylus on the screen to drag stuff around. And in this age of the iPhone, of course, every game uses that. But back then it was kind of new and people were like experimenting around and doing different ways of it. And I found it a good game, actually. I mean, a lot of people weren't, but it kind of had a nice mood to it. There were a couple of nice puzzles, most of which were okay. And then there was one puzzle that was utterly genius. This is definitely without a doubt. I mean, actually, Trace Memory and Hotel Dusk both had one puzzle in it that I thought was absolute genius. And even though some of the other puzzles in the game, they weren't that keen on. But I mean, this time it was both genius. What happened was, it's hard to explain. I'm not actually, okay, this is going to be a spoiler for anyone who's already played the game first. So I'm going to talk about it. So just plug your fingers and ears if you don't want to hear. In Hotel Dusk, for instance, there's this one stage where you basically solve a jigsaw puzzle. That's not a huge problem, right? You click and drag the jigsaw pieces. It's been done before and done since, blah, blah, blah. You complete the jigsaw puzzle, and then suddenly you say maybe there's a pattern on the other thing, on the other side of the puzzle. So then what happens is you got the DS open. On one side of the DS open, it's got two screens. One screen shows the puzzle, the other screen shows the tabletop. And nothing you do seems to do anything. So I tried to figure it out, then I had a genius thing. I flipped over the lid onto it, basically flipping the jigsaw puzzle over onto itself, closed the DS, opened it again, and yeah, the jigsaw puzzle had basically been flipped over onto its back. It was just so clever because it's actually using the hardware to engage with yourself and made it a lot more fun. In Trace Memory, they did something along the similar lines but completely different. They basically had a thing where you had to look, you ended up picking up this this thing that basically showed a picture on both screens. And in order to solve the puzzle, you had to like slightly bend the screen and look at one picture in such an angle that it showed a reflection of the other screen. And by the two reflection of one overlapping, by the one picture overlapping with the reflection of the other, it suddenly spelled out this, the pattern suddenly came together and you were given the solution for the next puzzle. So, I mean, I just thought, you know, there's some people who try to like play it on like devices or computers. I just thought, you know, if people just try to play these on computers again, they're so totally not going to figure out how to do that. It's just a clever way of using the hardware. I mean, Metal Gear Solid did something a little like that once. They actually had one puzzle that had to have you look at the actual, at the screenshots on the back of the box that the game was put in. So, I mean, obviously, if you ever were to download it online, that would cause a few problems. But I mean, I've always liked puzzles, and I've always liked being challenged in ways I don't expect. So when you suddenly get a puzzle and it makes you think beyond just the game, beyond what's ever right in front of you, and think of a whole new way, I just love that sort of stuff. So yeah. So I guess it's about time to move on to our final track. Yes, and okay, this is going to be an interesting one. I'm going to play an obscure track now, and when I say it's obscure, I don't just mean that it is actually somewhat obscure, as in not known about. I mean it's from the video game called Obscure. Well, actually, it's pronounced Obscure. It's got some funny capitalization going on there. But it's essentially a game by Hydrovision Entertainment. It is, it basically took inspiration from a couple of teen horror movies that were pretty popular around then. This is in the mid-noughties. And we're basically, suddenly monsters are going around the school, and a diverse amount of high school American stereotypes must cooperate in order to defeat whatever monster's going on and try to figure out what's going on and everything. Now, to be honest, once the monster starts attacking, it seems you try to, you know, I'd probably, if I was back in school and monster started attacking, I'd probably try to get out of there. But in this case, what they find it more productive to go around, explore, find a lot of hidden passages in the school, find a lot of secret hidden files, find keys that unlock doors to make more progress, to try to finally learn about what's going on, and then go head-to-head with the actual monster that's causing all these problems in the first place and the faculty members. So, yeah, it's kind of funny. I think it took a bit of inspiration from The Faculty, which is a movie that was around that time. I never saw that movie. All the guys in my school said, the teen horror guy in my school said I should totally see that. But anyway, it's fun because it's a bit cooperative. It's actually one of the few instances where actually the cooperative actually works, because, I mean, because you have to shine the flashlight at enemies to weaken them and then shoot them. That's a mechanic that got used in several other games such as Alan Wake, but in that way it's pretty cool because what I tend to do, even if though my co-op partner was controlled by the computer, I'd just shine spotlights at monsters, weakening them, and let the computer just shoot them out. And it's a great sort of sense. It made me realize that in, you know, a lot of cooperative games, you know, have both characters just shooting the enemies, but I like one where, you know, they leverage each other's abilities. I think it works better if one person's providing something that the others can't, or maybe if there's some way that they can just work together just in slightly different ways. It's just, I like that sort of stuff. I kind of found it a little disappointing, though, because in some ways I was expecting to see lots of cutscenes, you know, little movies showing the teen characters interacting, because, you know, as lame as sometimes the acting is in a lot of these teen movies and whatever, I kind of like it. There's something comforting about the just complete, you know, way, you know, lack of mind ways that some of these characters act. But unfortunately, after a couple of cutscenes, the game starts and it sort of lets, and pretty much it allows certain characters to be killed in the game, you know, if you do badly, and the rest continue on to complete the story. So because of that, they don't really make as many cutscenes, because then they would have to reshoot the same cutscene for what happens if it was a different character or a different character. So it's kind of pity, because I would have liked a bit of that. The music is very haunting. It is composed by Olivier Derivier, who and it's actually performed by the Children's Choir of the Opéra National de Paris. So it's clearly some quite a bit of pedigree behind this one. I mean, like many music, there's some serious stuff going on. The music also has the game also has music by Sum 41 and the Span, which are, you know, which are fine bands. You know, I kind of like Still Waiting. It's the sort of American, you know, rock group that tries to appeal to American teenagers who are so sick of everything that's going on with their lives and stuff, and so they have to listen to this music, which, you know, really gets it out. And I kind of like that sort of music. And of course, Sum 41 probably makes money out of it, so it's all fun. It's everyone wins in the end. And but I decided not to play those tracks and just stick with Olivier Derivier's works, because I figure, you know, you've probably heard Sum 41 somewhere else. So, you know, I think I'll stick with the path slightly less followed in any event. This is called Empty Halls, very atmospheric and ambient, and I think I'll leave it at that for all. Empty School. So I think I'll leave it at there, and I just want to say thank you all for listening, and hope to see you again. Remember, Monday, 3:30 p.m. Dublin South FM, and also available on podcast download. This has been David Collins. Thank you for listening.